It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. You know those times when you head out for a bite to eat and you're determined to stay on budget? You give a lot of thought to your order, the bill comes, and the budget's blown. Well, you have just experienced seduction by menu. I mean, here we are, the most marketed two people on the planet, and we're still, at least sometimes, babes in the woods when it comes to figuring out what's real value. Now take that menu. You weren't sucked in by the obvious, tempting language. Oh no, it's much more subtle than that. Our guest William Poundstone has done a study. He calls it priceless. So today, it's the menu as minefield, your calls, and much more on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, this is the time of year when I find myself looking longingly at airfares in the paper, dreaming of Thailand or Singapore or the south of France, which is not happening for me right now. But there is a way to get a little bit of a world food tour without the long flights. Get to a city with lots of different cultures. New York, for example. Now, skip the midtown spots. You want the neighborhoods. These are the home territories where cooks are feeding the people who know when the food's right because it's their food. It comes from their homeland. Now, in New York, the man to follow is Ed Levine. Between his food books, tours, and website, Ed knows the territory. Ed, it's good to have you back.
It's so nice to be with you, Lynn.
Ed, I have got such wanderlust. I mean, really, and I know New York is a place where I can kind of satisfy it. So can you help me out here?
Well, you know, the great thing is that you can either rent a chauffeur-driven limousine like it was prom night.
Right.
Or you can take the number 7 train out of Times Square. And then it stops at Grand Central. But once you hit Queens on the number 7 train, which
ends
up
across the East River from the island.
Right, just across the East River, you start going. It's like you've taken your index finger and you've drawn a circle around the globe. So one stop will be a great Thai neighborhood with a fantastic Thai restaurant, which will be right next to the oldest Cuban sandwich joint in New York. And then you get on the train and you go one more stop. And then, oh, wow, how did we get to Little India? And then right smack dab in the middle of Little India, there'll be a Uruguayan steakhouse. And then there'll be a Filipino barbecue joint. And it's almost disorienting. You know, it's that old David Byrne line from the Talking Heads song. You may ask yourself, how did I get here?
So, Ed, where would you have me stop?
I think I would first have you stop in Woodside, the 61st Street station, which is 61st Street and Roosevelt Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And then you would get off the train and you would walk a half a block. And you would see Sri Prafai, and I must apologize to any Thai listeners if I'm mangling the name of this restaurant. But it's a restaurant that was opened by a woman who had a day job as a nurse at a Queens hospital. And now, of course, it's moved a couple of times. It's much bigger. There's a garden. And she has long ago given up her day job, and it's now a family enterprise. But she is one of, you know, the best Thai cooks, certainly in New York and maybe anywhere in the country. And so, you know, I think people have to stop there. And, of course, it's right next to Donovan's, which is this really cool Irish pub where you can get a burger. So you've gotten off the train, you have a burger,
right,
and you've got fantastic Thai food. So, you know, that's a pretty good stop.
What about Chinese? Is there any, are there any great Chinese stops along
the
line?
Sure. Well, you know, the number 7 line ends up in Flushing, right? Ends up in Main Street in Flushing is actually the last stop.
And these, it's, by the way, these neighborhoods are all in this borough of Queens, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Flushing is eastern Queens. You're almost in Nassau County,
okay,
but not quite. You've gone past what was Shea Stadium and is now Citi Field. You've gone past where the U.S. Open is played.
Right.
And you get out on Main Street in Flushing and you think that you've just gotten off an 18-hour plane ride and you've landed in Shanghai. The range of Chinese food that is available to you is just remarkable. And, you know, there are all these food courts, but instead of, you know, the food courts being populated by national chains, they're populated by the ultimate mom and pop food businesses. There's a Peking duck window. That's literally a street food vendor selling Peking duck pancakes for, I think it's $1.75. You can't beat it.
Now, I've heard rumors about a Colombian hot dog.
Also, on Roosevelt Avenue, I believe you'd get off at 103rd Street, which is between Sri Prafai and the Chinatown in Flushing.
Right.
And that is, in fact, a Central and South American neighborhood. And there is a what could only be described as a combination juice bar hot dog place. Now, you might not have known, Lynn, that the Colombians really love hot dogs.
Not in a million years would I know this.
Yes. But the toppings are what makes them so distinctive, canned pineapple and potato chips. It's kind of tasty in its own way.
It sounds kind of tasty.
Down it with a banana papaya juice and I don't know, you might be feeling pretty good.
Hey, I'm up for this. Hey, Ed, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ed Levine tracks down the food life of New York's neighborhoods through his books, tours, and on his website, Serious Eats. Now, to get Ed's guide for the number 7 train adventure, head to our site, splendidtable.org. And, you know, be sure to slow down and take a look at your town. We often spend our days on automatic pilot, so take a look around, especially in the parts of town that you don't get to. And speaking of our own backyards, hey, it's coming on to CSA time. Community-supported agriculture, as in buying a piece of the farm. You know, one of the really good things about a CSA is, besides the utter freshness of the produce, you get a bit of a challenge in the kitchen as well. I mean, when else are you going to need to figure out what to do with 4 pounds of zucchini week after week after week? Now, if you look at this as a challenge, I promise it's going to be a real blast. And by the way, there are even some farmers with winter CSAs, as in frozen foods. Now, you can take a look at some of the sources for CSA information that we found. They're all on the website, splendidtable.org. It's time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. With me is our noble celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball, host of America's Test Kitchen and creator and editor of Cooks Illustrated. Chris, it is good to have you back.
Did you say ignoble or noble?
No, noble.
Okay.
Noble.
Okay.
Noble. We're starting out on a positive note this week.
It will not end that way, I'm sure.
Can you lay out the rules and find out who's playing?
The rules are there are 5 ingredients from the refrigerator that you have to work with. You get a free pass on water, salt, and pepper, and some sort of fat like oil. Plus, you can use up to 3 other ingredients they happen to have in their kitchen, and you have to come up with a recipe that I think is worthwhile making, and the contestant also has to agree.
So who's our contestant?
We have Victoria. Hi, Victoria. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
And where are you from?
I am the food service director at Tall Timber Ranch, and we are a camp up in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State.
Oh, this will be interesting. Bear meat.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, well, first of all, that's the most beautiful country.
It is beautiful.
All right, so I'm bracing myself, Victoria.
What's in the fridge?
Okay, well, you know, at camp we have to be pretty thrifty, so I have some leftovers for you, and also we have good foraging here, so I have some other exciting things.
Ooh.
And we also have 5 shares in our local CSA. So, here you go, then. I have 1 gallon of leftover cooked oatmeal, and it was cooked with butter and cinnamon. I have 35 hard-boiled eggs. I have 15 kiwis, 30 porcini mushrooms.
You have, wait a minute, stop right there, girl. You have 30 porcini mushrooms?
I probably have more, but I'll only give you 30.
Oh, I love it. Okay, so that's 4.
Hey, what's the
last? That's 4. I have 10 pounds of mixed grazing greens, and if you want to know, it's half collards and half Swiss chard.
Ooh.
Oh, she likes bitter greens. Yeah.
I'm going to give you a 6 ingredient. You can choose to use it or not, but my original call was, what do I do with Worcestershire sauce? Because I do have 1.5 gallons of it.
This I got to see. I'm hopeful.
This might be the end.
This might be the last one.
You worked really hard to make it hard.
Thank you.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
so glad. Yeah. Have you got olive oil?
Oh, yeah. Extra virgin.
Extra, of course.
About 3 gallons.
I may not do this in large quantity, but let's say big skillet, film bottom with olive oil. We want some garlic.
Oh, I've got about 100 heads.
That's good. We don't need 100. We just need 1 or 2 for the 10 pounds of collards and chard. And the other thing I think I would like in here, do you have any fresh chilies?
Yeah, I have some jalapenos and some other big green ones.
Okay, chop up some of those jalapenos, and this is what you're going to do. You're going to heat that oil, all right? Take some chopped onion, and you're going to saute it until it begins to just pick up a tiny bit of color. You're going to stir in the chopped collards and the chopped chard with the garlic and the chili, and you're going to saute that down. And what you're going to do is then add a little bit of Worcestershire sauce. And you're going to boil it off.
Okay.
All right? But it's going to form a flavor base. It's going to bring a lot of savoriness to this sauté. Okay, so what you're going to do then is you're going to cook this down, and you may have to add some water to the skillet. You want to soften the collard greens, but you don't want them sloppy.
Right.
So as you're cooking that, you're going to take those hard-cooked eggs, and you're going to quarter them. You're going to take more olive oil, all right? You're going to saute sliced up porcini. You want to slice them vertically so that you get the slices of the cap, and then you get that whole stem. And you want to really, in that olive oil in another skillet, get them seared on the outside, almost crusty, and then just get them out of the pan and give them some salt. You're going to take olive oil and vinegar. Salt and pepper, obviously, a dash of the Worcestershire, and you're going to make a dressing out of that.
Okay.
A vinaigrette. Now, what you're going to do, now hold on a minute, hold on a minute. You're going to take the oatmeal, right?
Can you do 2 meals of this to do breakfast, and then you can come back for lunch?
I have to do 1 dish.
Okay.
You're going to take teaspoons of the oatmeal.
Thickener.
Now you're going to cut up the kiwi.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
And you're going to pan fry oatmeal cakes. Little tiny oatmeal cakes. And what you're going to do is put them on a very large platter. You only need 3 or 4 of them.
Desperation.
Yes, you got it. And then what you do is you take those collard greens and you pile them on that platter. Okay. Mm-hmm. Top those collard greens by just studding them here and there with the wedges of the hard cooked eggs. Sprinkle everything with a tad of salt. And then what you want to do is lay those crisp, really lovely pieces of porcini over that. And that is your combination. And
the oatmeal cake. Where's the oatmeal cake? The little
right
cake.
At the bottom.
Oh, there
underneath
at the bottom.
Everything. There's only 3 or 4.
You hid those.
Well, I'm pretty impressed because I couldn't think of anything to do with that oatmeal other than make bread with it. So
I think even a scoffier probably wouldn't do any better. So you squeak by. It was close. I mean, those little kiwi chunks of the oatmeal cakes, whatever. Yeah.
Guys, Victoria, I wish you a lot of luck with the camp.
Oh, thank you.
You may not get return guests.
Well, if you're out cutting down timber all day, you'll be hungry enough for this. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you very much, sir.
Well, a squeak's still a win.
Thank you. It makes me feel a lot better. Our guest celebrity stuntmaster is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cooks Illustrated and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, to play Stump the Cook, call or email us with five things in your refrigerator, and one of our sneaky producers may call you to be on the air. Coming up, outsmarting restaurant menu psychology and the zeitgeist of ice fishing. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Okay, here's the scene. You're out to eat, you sit down, and you're handed a menu. Now, for us, the menu is an invitation to enjoy ourselves. But there could be an agenda here, one that we are not supposed to know about. Its goal is to get us to spend more money. No surprise. Well, writer William Poundstone has been researching what makes us spend money. Now, his book is called Priceless: The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. William Poundstone, welcome.
Good to be with you.
You know, when I think of a menu, I think of a menu as being essentially, well, if you want to romanticize it, an invitation to pleasure. But I kind of have a feeling that's not what it is. So what did you find out in the research?
Yeah, this is fascinating because, as you say, a menu is supposed to be the classic example of free choice. But menu designers have found that there's many different ways of getting you to order what the restaurant wants you to order without even realizing that you're being manipulated. Now, one of the things they've found, of course, restaurants have certain dishes that are very profitable and certain dishes that aren't so profitable. So they want to kind of gently nudge you to order those profitable dishes. And one of the things they do is draw a box around various items on a menu. Now, it sounds simple, but the eye is automatically drawn to that box, and they found that people are more likely to order whatever is in the box. So that's really where they put the stuff that is either very profitable or which they think showcases the chef's talents.
So is that going to be a good bet for the consumer or not?
Well, it's hard to say. It's what they make a lot of profit on. So, you know, depending on the restaurant, it might be a good buy and it might not. Another trick they use, often inside one of those boxes, you'll see something outrageously expensive. Like there are places that'll have a $150 hamburger. And the first thing everyone does is look at that and shake their head and say, how could anyone spend that kind of money on a hamburger?
Right.
But the thing is, then you go down the menu and you look and maybe there's a $50 steak. And suddenly that $50 steak doesn't seem so outrageous since you've just seen that $150 hamburger. And again, we're laughing about this, but they have done studies in psychology labs and also in restaurants and found that it really works this way. And just by having that $150 hamburger on the menu, people will spend more money than they would have, even if they don't spend it on the hamburger.
What is the psychology behind the large portion and the small portion? You know, you can order the half salad or the full salad or the half sandwich and the full sandwich.
Yeah, that's a technique that's known as bracketing. And of course, the consumer really has no way of judging how big the portions are or what's a good deal or not. But one of the things that people have found is that people are very sensitive to contrast, and some people just like to feel that they've got a bargain. So that type of consumer can order the smaller size, figure he saves some dollars, he saves some calories, and he's happy with it. Other people will order the large size, and that's even better.
Which is most profitable for the restaurant?
It's often the small size, surprisingly. They really give you the size they intended to serve all along as the small size and charge what they intended. Mm-hmm. But just by having that larger size there, a lot of people will decide they're going to save money by ordering what they wanted you to order in the first place.
Yeah. You have three menus pictured in the book, and these are from higher-end restaurants. And two of them look like classic French bistro menus. And then the third menu is what I see in a lot of restaurants where there's these long descriptions, pan-roasted cod with aromatic vegetables, blood orange, lobster broth, and black olive oil. I mean, and there's a lot of white space. The others are tighter. Why are these three menus in the book?
Yeah, well, they found that even the typography can dictate what you choose. In the old-fashioned type of menu, you'll notice that the prices are often in a very neat column. There's even leader dots leading from the item to the price. And they found that when presented with that kind of menu, people's eyes will just scan down the price list to look at what's cheapest, and they'll tend to pick what seems to be a good deal. But, of course, that's not what restaurants want you to do.
Right.
They want you to first decide what you want, and then hopefully it'll be a high-profit item. So in the newer kind of restaurant menus where they're using these menu consultants, one of the things they tell them to do is to have lots of text description, as you say, because that's a way of focusing on the food, not the price. And they use center justification so that, in other words, the prices don't all end up in a straight line. This makes it a lot harder to go down and compare prices. And although it's a very small thing, you know, choosing an item from a menu is one of life's smaller decisions. So any little nudge like that can cause you to pay less attention to prices and more to what you actually want. And of course, they make sure to have the longest descriptions on the items that are the most profitable.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I'm looking at the menus. The other thing is there are never any dollar signs on these menus.
Yeah, that's another recommendation. They try to minimize the attention you're going to pay to prices. One way to do it is just remove the dollar signs, remove the decimal points, remove the cents figures. And on the more expensive restaurants, that's what they tend to do nowadays.
So for we consumers now knowing this, should we be taking just a second look at that menu?
Well, I've found it certainly changes my experience at restaurants because you get so you can spot these tricks. I mean, it's almost like knowing how a good magician performs illusions, and it is kind of fun to look at it. But I've got to warn you, I talked to some of these consultants, and they said, it's like, you know, if I tell you don't think of an elephant, you have to think of an elephant. And these tricks work even if you know how they work.
Nothing like being a victim at the restaurant. Thank you so much, Bill.
Well, thank you.
Take care. William Poundstone is author of Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value and How to Take Advantage of It. When Jerry Seinfeld makes a great North Country tradition part of a new sitcom, I figure it's time to get the real story. Now, I'm talking about ice fishing. A promo for Seinfeld's new series was shot in an ice house in Duluth, Minnesota. Now, for those who have never heard of an ice house, consider it a new way of sourcing dinner locally, as in from under your feet. Greg Brining has written the book, A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. More to the point, Greg actually ice fishes. Greg, welcome.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
Well, Greg, okay, what kind of human sits on a block of ice? More specifically, a frozen lake for I don't know how long to fish.
Well, all kinds of humans, but they what they have in common is that they probably grew up in a place like Minnesota or Wisconsin or even Russia, someplace with fish and ice and fishermen. And, you know, there are people like me for whom ice fishing is the second best thing because we like to fish when it's warm and the water is liquid and we can see the fish jump and all that stuff.
Right.
But this is the second best option. But there are people for whom ice fishing is the best fishing of all. You know, they like to be able to go out on their four-wheeler or snowmobile or to be able to walk, you know, like Jesus to their fishing spot, walk on water. And then there are people that just like sitting in the ice house. It's their cabin on the lake, literally.
Yeah, literally, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in Minnesota, the people talk about raising their families in ice houses.
Well, actually, I did talk to a number of people on Mille Lacs Lake, which is known for not only great walleye fishing, but great great ice fishing and wonderful ice houses, huge ice houses, practically the size of boxcars out there. And a number of them said that the reason they built these big, luxurious fish houses was so they could bring the whole family out there with them.
But I think you've got to explain what an ice house is.
Well, an ice house is simply a shelter without a floor. Well, it's got a floor, but it's got holes in the floor. So you drag it out on the ice, set it down, and then drill holes so that you can sit in some degree of warmth and comfort while dangling a lure through the ice trying to catch a fish.
You mentioned Russia, and I don't think of Russians ice fishing.
Well, actually, Russians are enthusiastic ice fishermen. The first time I went there, I saw all these people sitting literally in the shadow of the Kremlin on the Moscow River, staring down blankly at the ice. Now, if I hadn't been from Minnesota, I would have been puzzled as to what they were doing, but I knew they were ice fishing. And so the next time I went to Russia, I got an assignment with Sports Illustrated to do something on ice fishing on the Volga River. It's the only time I've gone ice fishing that I had to get permission from the KGB. And so we went out one dark night and got to the Volga River by sunrise, and there were hundreds, just hundreds of Russians. They would come down out of the hills on motorcycles and surplus military vehicles, just streaming out onto the ice of the Volga River. And by the way, they didn't have houses. They just sat out there like, you know, like regular ice fishermen, mm-hmm. on buckets or on the ice itself, or sitting kind of side saddle on their motorcycles. Mm-hmm. But they had these ice fishing rigs, these tiny little rods and reels that were so sensitive with such light line and tiny lures. These are the fishing rods that you could use to catch guppies out of your aquarium. I mean, that's how sensitive they were. Mm-hmm. So they would catch these little perch and this little silvery fish called a lesh, and it was kind of like a big minnow, and those were the fish they were going after.
Greg, is there a dream fish for an ice fisherman?
Oh, my. No. Unless you're at Pout Festival. Maybe then the eel pout would be the nightmare fish,
What's the dream fish.
Eel pout is a freshwater cod. And it's actually a delightful fish. It has firm white meat that's very mild, like cod. But around here, we don't really make use of it. What is notable about the eel pout, besides its name, is a remarkably repulsive appearance. It's got barbels and blotchy skin, and when it comes out of the hole, it tends to wrap around your arm like an eel.
Oh, how attractive.
So that kind of puts some people off. I don't know why. Actually, one of the best fish to eat, and it's really kind of a specialty around here of ice fishing, is the yellow perch. We normally think of perch as kind of a small nuisance fish, but when you get on big lakes, the perch are oftentimes big and plump, and they taste like walleyes, except they're even sweeter and milder. They're really a lovely fish.
Mm, this sounds great. Greg, thank you.
My pleasure.
Greg Brining is author of A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. Well, I've got the perfect fish stew. You can find Ice House Fish Stew on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our weeknight kitchen e-newsletter, show podcasts, and our special recipe collection, Cheap Eats. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Well, since we're talking about tracking down your own dinner, let me stretch the point from the ice house to finding the hometown place that has not been wiped off the map by chain restaurant blight. Jane and Michael Stern are sort of the white knights here. They hunt down these places and they tell all on their road food website and here. Hey, you two, welcome. Good to have you back.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So what were you guys looking for on the last trip you took?
We were primarily looking for great crab cakes. And I think we've talked with you fairly recently about the delicious, huge lump crab cakes you can find all along the Chesapeake Bay.
Right.
And one of the places we found some really good crab cakes was at a place called The Cove in Crisfield, Maryland. And you know Crisfield is serious about crabs because they have a giant crab painted on their water tower. However, in addition to excellent lump meat crab cakes, mm-hmm. we found something at the Cove that we had never even heard of before, and it turns out to be the state dessert of Maryland.
Which nobody's ever heard of.
I know there's a bird. There's a flower. I didn't know there was dessert.
I'm not
well,
sure.
It's not the bird or the flower.
I don't know how many states do have a formal official dessert, but Maryland does.
And it's Smith Island cake.
Smith Island is one of two inhabited islands in the Chesapeake Bay.
Tanger and Smith.
The people who inhabit it go back, way back to pre-colonial times. They came here from the British Isles, and I don't want to say they've remained inbred, but they haven't diversified the way the rest of the country. It's sort of like gullah culture is in Georgia
right.
and South Carolina.
Right.
They have their own way
of talking, of cooking. Elizabethan brogue almost. It's a very interesting accent.
It's like nothing else that I've ever heard. But the important thing is that for whatever reason, they have this thing that they make called Smith Island cake. No one knows exactly where it came from. And in fact, its origins are not nearly as old as the ancestors of the people who live on the island. I think it only goes back to the mid-20th century. But what it looks like, if you see it on a plate, it looks like a Hungarian dobos tort. It's like 10 micro-thin layers of cake with 10 micro-thin layers of frosting between each one.
And the Cove in Crisfield, where you know we had these spectacular crab cakes and crab sliders, these little teeny-weeny crab cakes, actually gets this Smith Island cake from people who bring it in by boat every day from Smith Island. So it's the real deal.
So what is the Cove like? Are you actually on the water when you're dining?
No, there's nothing really romantic about this place. You have a view of the water, but it's kind of on a side back street in Crisfield. It is not a scenic restaurant, which, of course, you know, that means it's our favorite kind of restaurant. I don't want to say it's a dump, but it's the kind of place that you might drive past and say, let's find a more romantic place to eat, honey.
Tavern-like.
Yeah, it is. Jane's got it. It's kind of tavern-like.
Which is really what all the great restaurants in that area really do look like. It's a style of Maryland eating.
This is good to know. This is a good clue. Guys, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest work is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can find all their picks, past and present, on the website splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the newest darling for masochistic chili lovers? Well, I'm going to be back with that answer in a moment, and I'm going to be talking with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. Call us or go online, splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the newest darling for masochistic chili lovers? Well, it is the ghost chili, also known as the poison chili, not very reassuring, and the pepper comes from Northeast India. The people raised with this chili, the ones who eat it every day, say eating it is like dying, and they love it. It's an alluring pepper, by the way. I mean, it really looks so innocent. It's about 3 inches long. It's this gorgeous orange red, and it has sort of a slightly pebbled skin. Now, to get a handle on how hot this baby is, you have to know there's a Scoville scale that measures chili heat. Now, the old hottest of the hot, the searing habanero, comes in at 580,000 Scoville units. The ghost chili hits, are you ready for this? 1,001,304 Scoville units. Well, I tasted it last summer. I mean, barely a shaving, and I thought I was going to die. One website says it's like eating battery acid. For me, it was like being stabbed with fire. In fact, it was so hot, I stopped hearing for a moment. Why did I do this? Well, anything for research, guys.
Hello. How are you? yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, how you feeling?
It's time for us to talk. Give us a call. Anything goes. We're opening up the lines. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or at splendidtable.org. Let's see, who have we got on the line? We have got Gus calling from Texas. Hey, Gus, what do you want to talk about?
I am planning a New Mexico dinner for my neighbors, and I have a question about wine selection.
Ooh, okay.
Tentative menu, and I say tentative, but it's pretty much fixed.
Right. So it's the fixed tentative menu.
A fixed tentative menu, right. I changed it once, is going to be borracho beans.
Right.
New Mexico style enchiladas, which are flat corn tortillas with grated onion and cheese and covered with red or green chili.
Okay.
And a fried egg on top.
Sounds wonderful.
Tamales, which I will not make. Tamales.
But you live in a place.
I live in a place where I can get tamales.
Right, right.
I've got a red wine. I've got a New Mexico red wine, a couple of New Mexico reds.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife is allergic to red wine, so I need a white. Our favorite restaurant owner has suggested margaritas.
No, I don't think
instead
so.
Instead of wine, but I don't like margaritas.
No,
I don't mind serving them to other people, but...
Well, margaritas with food, other than chips and, you know, salsa, it's too conflicting. It's another whole collection of flavors in your mouth. And what you've got there is a menu of spice and great texture. And the flavors are pretty pure. I mean, you're not talking about a huge jumble. I wouldn't mess around with margaritas. But I'm going to follow our wine guy, Josh Wesson's advice. If you think about what you would normally drink with this kind of food, it would be beer. So what you – because you want it crisp and you want it very fresh, because what you want to do is contrast with those tastes. And you want it pretty clean.
Yeah.
So instead of beer, what I would do is a reasonably priced sparkling wine, and it would be white. And
sparkling, okay.
Yeah.
I had thought of Pinot.
No,
I hadn't
don't
thought
do
of
it.
Sparkling
don't
wine
do it. The Pinot is going to be mowed down by these tastes. There's a very respectable sparkling wine made in New Mexico. It's by the people called Gruet, G-R-U-E-T. And I think they actually use the champagne method. But trust me, we have been pouring this wine for quite a while. It is delicious. And it's going to be utterly wonderful with this food. And it's reasonably priced. You are home free.
Well, thank you. Thank you, and thanks for the advice. I would have... Sparkling wine is not something that comes to mind.
It's interesting, but we're going after what Josh would call the stunt double for beer.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All righty. Thank you.
You take care.
Okay. Bye.
800-537-5252. Give us a call. Anything goes. Online, go to splendidtable.org. We've got Carrie on the phone from Seattle. Carrie, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about the Vietnamese soup pho.
Ooh. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of the mom and apple pie to me of Southeast Asia. But so what's the question?
Well, you know, I love it. I crave it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though it costs around, what, $5 a gallon?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a student, and I can't afford to buy it all the time. So I'd love to make it at home. But I don't really know even what goes into pho to make it unique. And so I don't really know what to look for even in a recipe. So I wondered if you could give me some direction on what to look for in a recipe.
Well, what pho is, and by the way, there's a cheater's pho I can tell you about. Pho, which is spelled P-H-O, and you often see it on menus, P-H-O, and you think it's pho, but it's really pho. And it is a soup that is done with beef, usually. And spices. And then you know you have the what they call a table salad on the side, which would have things like fresh basil and coriander, maybe mint and bean sprouts and chilies and wedges of lime that you squeeze into the soup. And you kind of flavor the soup to your taste. And it'll often have some kind of beef in it. Thin sliced, inexpensive beef that has been simmered in it for a long time. Or it might have, you know, more expensive beef that's dropped in at the last minute, so it's actually rare. But here's how you would generally make it. You would buy things like beef neck, anything with a lot of bone. You could buy beef ribs even. And then you want onion, a fair amount of ginger, and you want some star anise or just anise seed. Okay, and if you buy in a place where they sell bulk spices, you just need a couple of these.
Okay.
And in the case of anise seed, you need the equivalent of maybe 2 teaspoons of it.
Okay.
And you want garlic, and one of the essentials is Asian fish sauce. Mm. Now, Asian fish sauce is something that you're going to find. You're in Seattle?
Oh, right.
This is going to be a piece of cake.
Absolutely.
But $3.99 gets you a 2-year supply.
Right.
And I store it in the fridge. I mean, not that you have to, but I store it in the fridge. It's a little fresher. Mm-hmm. Okay, now you take the meat, you put that into water to cover, and you bring it to a simmer and immediately drain it.
Okay.
A lot of scum is going to rise up and sort of cloudy stuff. You drain that and then put it back in the pot. Okay, you cover it with water by about maybe 2 inches, and you very gently simmer it, very, very, very gently, for maybe 2 hours.
Oh.
Now, the meat itself, although it's going to be cooked and cooked, you can pull out, and you can chill that broth and take the fat off, and now you've got the foundation for the pho.
Okay.
But the meat, you can eat on its own. You could add it back into the pho in shreds or bits and pieces.
Okay.
So you're getting, you see, a lot out of this. Okay, so now we've got the broth. Now, what are you going to do with all those seasonings? Okay, you're going to take a piece of foil. You're going to turn on your broiler, slice up a big onion, and just spread it out. You're going to take a couple of star anise or a couple of teaspoons of anise seed. You're going to do, crush up maybe 2 inches of ginger. Smash it around, spread that out. About 6 cloves of garlic. You smash those. And then what you're going to do is I don't think I've forgotten anything. No. And then you're going to put that under the broiler for about 3 minutes.
Oh. Okay.
And it's going to char.
Uh-huh.
Very lightly, but it'll char. Now, you've defatted the broth. It's sitting on the stove. Just dump all of that into the broth.
Yeah.
You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you simmer that for about 30 minutes maybe to flavor it. Add a couple of teaspoons of fish sauce, a couple of teaspoons of sugar, all right?
Uh-huh.
Taste it to see if it needs salt. And then you take your rice noodles, which you can just soak in hot water.
Uh-huh.
Put the rice noodles in the bottom of the bowl. Pour in the broth. Have some, you know, bean sprouts if you want. Have whatever you feel is going to work for you for your budget.
Right.
So if you have some fresh coriander, that would be there. If you have some lemon or lime, that would be there.
And if I wanted to add some vegetables, would you saute those before adding them?
No. You know what you would do? Fresh. And just thin slice them and drop them in at the last minute.
Oh, okay.
And if you've got some of that leftover beef, you can throw that in.
Yeah.
And by the way, you can put anything in that broth you want.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've put in, you know, bok choy. I've put in regular cabbage. I've put in leftover salad greens that are a little on the wilted side. You can put anything you want.
Okay.
So that's essentially how you do your own homemade pho.
Oh, that will be so wonderful.
And all Vietnamese cooking authorities out there, please don't send me outraged emails, okay? All right? This is the way I do it.
It sounds good. It's economical. It'll clean out the fridge and taste delicious.
Exactly. And by the way, the broth freezes beautifully.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah. So you can pull it out, you know, when you're working late in the library and you come home and you want a big bowl, you just pull it out and throw it, you know, on the stove and cook it up.
Wonderful. This is going to be delicious.
Hey, thank you for a great question.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn.
Okay, Carrie. Take care. Bye.
You. Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. I have figured out the coolest way to roast a chicken. Okay, now follow me on this. I make this mix that I keep in a jar in the refrigerator, and this is what it is. You get a can of chipotle chili in adobo. That's what it's going to say on the label. This is the smoky, hot, hot chili in a tomato sauce. You dump the whole can into a food processor. You throw in some pitted prunes, okay, some vinegar. You have lots of garlic, and if you want, a little sugar. You puree that up, and it's going to taste smoky, hot, and sweet. Then you take a chicken, you cut right through the back. You go right down along the backbone. You splay it out, all right, so it's butterflied. You put that in a shallow roasting pan, and you slather it with this mixture. Now, as I said, I keep some in the fridge because what I do is I do a double recipe of the mix, and then I cover it with vinegar, and I put it in a glass jar in the refrigerator. But anyway, you want a fair amount of this. You really want to coat the chicken. And then I roast it at 350, and I keep basting it with all of that mix, which picks up all of the juices. It is utterly delicious. And then what you get is this nice roasted chicken with a golden skin, and all of that wonderful goop gets browned, and it gets to be nubby, and some of it is really saucy. And this reheats gorgeously. So that's it. A chipotle fruit puree with roasted chicken. Call us. 800-537-5252. We've got Diane calling from the Twin Cities. Diane, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I just saw the movie Julie and Julia.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was adorable, and it made me want to learn how to cook. However, I am not a cook at all, and so I decided once a week I'm going to make a meal that I haven't had before. It doesn't have to be fancy or anything, and should probably be pretty cheap since I really don't have a lot of money.
Right.
So I went out and bought a couple of basic cookbooks, and I tried one last week, and it was terrible because it was so boring. Like, it was just chicken. No, it was pasta and olive oil and parsley, and it was just really boring. So I'm just wondering if you have any ideas.
I hate to say it. You know, I'll eat pasta anyway, but, boy, that does sound boring.
I know. I was so disappointed, and I was all excited about my new adventure in life.
What would you like to start with? I mean, would you like to do a great pasta that's cheap?
Yeah, pasta would be good. I actually went out last night to the store and bought some just different ingredients of food that sounded yummy to me.
Like which ones?
I bought chicken breast and red and green pepper.
Ooh.
And then two maroon-colored onions. And then maple brown sugar oatmeal, pumpkin pie spice, and parsley specks. I don't know if any of that works.
We're playing
together.
Stump the Cook. I love it. This is great.
Yeah, I don't know if any of that would work together or not, but that's what I'll thought. And mini marshmallows, of course.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we're going to do the marshmallows, but you know what? Over pasta, you never know. No, but seriously, wait a second. Let's see what we can do with this.
Okay.
All right? Okay. Let's do something with those chicken breasts that you can vary.
Okay.
All right? So here's the deal. You're going to cut up the onion and the pepper into one-inch squares.
One-inch squares.
All right. And then you're going to take the chicken breast, slice that into thin slices, okay, and do it across the width of the breast. And you're going to take – do you have any olive oil in the house?
Yes.
All right. So here's the deal. You're going to take the chicken breast. You're going to take those strips. You're going to heat the oil in a big, shallow pan. All right?
Okay.
Okay? Heat that over medium-high heat. You're going to throw the chicken breast slices in there, stir them around, add salt, pepper, and sprinkle them with some of the pumpkin pie spice.
Salt, pepper, and pumpkin pie spice.
Right. And you're going to saute them. Keep the heat pretty, like, medium to medium low until they lose, until they're white, okay? They no longer look raw. Now, get them out of the pan, but try to leave as much of the oil in as you can.
Okay.
If it needs more oil, add a teeny bit more. You just want to film the bottom. Now add that diced pepper and onion. A little more salt and pepper, okay?
Okay.
Saute that medium heat until it starts to get soft. It's going to be, you're going to see that the onion is going to get clear, all right? Ooh. That's your signal. And then what I want you to do is to squeeze half a lemon over that. Throw the chicken back in the pan. Toss it around. Okay?
Okay.
And then you can just have that straight. You can put that over pasta. You can put that over rice.
Ooh.
That's a beginning. It's a very simple way to do it.
Okay.
But that pumpkin pie spice is cinnamon and allspice and nutmeg, and it's going to be pretty tasty in there.
Fantastic.
So you see, you've made a sauté, and you're in good shape because now you can do that with any vegetable. Okay?
Okay.
And you're going to want to learn to do maybe three things that are going to be basics. You want to learn to do this kind of basic sauté where it could be done with fish, it could be done with any meat, it could be done with any vegetable. You want to learn to roast a chicken. Okay?
Chicken.
All right?
Okay.
And you want to learn to make a really simple soup.
Really simple soup.
Mm-hmm. You can go on websites, et cetera. But you don't want short recipes. You want recipes that tell you the details you need to know. All those questions that you know are going to come up as you read the recipe should answer them. So beware of these recipes that have three sentences.
Okay.
They're not easy. Okay, so there's where you begin, Diane.
All right, wonderful. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. All Take right. care.
Bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, "Sweets for the sweet create big business for dentists." Splendid Table is distributed by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Well, our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. She is not a Jennifer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.